Well, good afternoon, everyone. I just want to let you all know how excited I am to be back here this afternoon. This, I believe, was the very first rumor I ever gave an SAA presentation in. And that's the first reason I'm excited to be back here. The second reason is because the Society really has given so much to me over the years I've been in it, both in terms of professional service opportunities and publication opportunities, and more so in terms of friendships. I see a lot of friends in the room here this afternoon. I appreciate that very much. Those of you who heard the talk I gave here, I don't know, it was 5 years or so ago, may remember at the time a fairly nervous, you know, young man stepping forward, wanting to point out to the profession what he saw as a few inconvenient truths at the time about description. I can say that with the two descriptive gurus sitting right in my lap up front here. So I'd like to begin this talk as well with what I see as some inconvenient truths at this time. These are based on a survey of descriptive practices that I've just recently completed. Basically, I looked at 91 college and university archives. If you really want to know all the gory details of it, you can go over to Reykjavik. I'll be giving the talk over there in about a month or so at the International Council on Archives meeting. But anyway, I'm just going to present these as truths. You're going to have to accept them as fact right now. I do show that they're true in my paper. Fact number one, this will not come as a surprise to many of you, but over two-thirds of all archives consider at least 30% of their collections to be unprocessed. And that's not much of a surprise. I mean, Dennis Meissner and Mark Green have pointed that out. Unlike their study, I looked more specifically at descriptive practices. So fact number two, an average institution, and this is among college and university archives, which should have good access to descriptive tools, an average institution provides information online for only 50% of its collections. Nearly a third of the institutions provide online information for 10% or less of their collections. Fact number three, this effect is felt most disproportionately among small archives. Not terribly surprising, but still, it's a very strong effect. You can read about it. And on the other thing, this study I did will be published in the College and University Archives Reader when that comes out in about a year, year and a half or so. Fact number three, the use of practices such as using EAD encoding tools, using cataloging software, doing HTML markup, all correlate strongly both to backlog size and more specifically to processing inefficiency measured in cubic feet of processing done per processor per year. Okay. Now, while I was coming up with all of this, I was closely monitoring the EAD listserv and looking at some of the messages that come across. And, you know, as I was looking at those, I kind of got to thinking. I said, well, what are some of these like? And, you know, I thought, well, why don't you just go to the next slide here, Chris? You all remember Rube Goldberg, right? Here's Rube's picture snapping machine. I thought, you know, this actually fairly closely parallels what we were doing in the university archives. You have this gentleman sitting on the pneumatic cushion, vaguely balding, you know, that would be me. You have him trying to push some information through a very narrow tube. In other words, get it into EAD or get it into MARC format. Starts off the ice bolt, that's our XSLT processor. Okay, causing a lighted cigar, but I actually haven't thought of a nice analogy for that one to explode. But then the dictator hearing the loud report, that's how bad your processing efficiency is. Your library director finding that out, falls backwards, so on and so forth. Luckily, most of us have been hiding those processing inefficiencies. So anyway, we're here to tell you today that we have a little application that we think can help you out. We're not sure if it'll help everybody out, whether it'll help a subset of the community out, but we want to propose it to you today as one potential solution. So at this point, I'm going to turn things over to Scott Schwartz. Scott's my colleague at the University of Illinois. Scott's the director of the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, previously worked at the Smithsonian Institution as archivist of the Duke Ellington Collection. And Scott has a lot of other nice little academic credentials, which I'll skip over in the interest of brevity. While Scott's talking, our lead developer on the project, Chris Rischel, who is an undergraduate student at the University of Illinois, will be kind of running interference, I guess. In other words, showing off the application as we go about. Chris is a very brilliant programmer. He's actually applying to medical scholar PhD programs at the moment. So if you know any admissions officers at those very competitive programs, we have one very smart gentleman here. After that, we'll have one other speaker, and then Scott will be reading one of the papers for one attendee who was unable to attend. So, Chris, if you want to just close out of my presentation, then I'll turn it over to Scott.
Thank you. Let's get right to the top. Key message here, the program was developed as an open source application. It was designed for the individual who was either unwilling or didn't have an inclination to bury themselves in all kinds of technological requirements. I use the analogy that nun who at 65 retires from one set of responsibilities and then responsible for the diocese or the nunnery's papers. And she wants to get her stuff online. But she doesn't want to do all the technology. And quite frankly, if she didn't have to use the computer, she'd be much happier about that, too. All right. We have people in our offices just like that, okay? Or we may be one of those individuals. You just don't have enough time. When I took the first EAD class that Chris and Michael gave, I was not a good student. I confess. I asked lots of hard questions. I would be probably described as a real pain in the ass because I was unwilling to devote all the time necessary to code in EAD. I didn't see a major return for the effort. So I thought there's got to be a better way. And I said there probably is. And I told Michael that. And mentioned last year, we've got something really cool we're doing, and I think we're right there. And he said, okay, can you take EAD and spit it out, and can you pump it back in? He says, he'll come and see it if we can do both. Chris sent the email last week, and his response was, cool. So, yeah, we're there. The concept is simple. Input once, output many different ways. Okay. At the end of the session, we're giving this away free. Okay? It's so easy, I hope that literally there'll be a stampede for what disks I still have left. Okay? And we have another way to get it to you if you don't get a disk. Let's start with the public interface, and I've got to stick this up because there, that's better. Okay. Yeah, okay, I hate speaking in front of these things. We're just going to give a quick tour through the public interface and the administrative components. We just don't have enough time to show you all the nuts and bolts. But then again, that's what the free disk is for, so you can sit there, take it home, load it quick, and play. Okay. First part, you come in and you have a simple interface. This is just part of the search component for the website. The University Archives and the SUSE Archives run off the same data set, but our websites look totally different. But nevertheless, we're running off the same data set. We've taken just the finding aid section. Let's do a quick search on some topic of your choice. And, got it. And just let's go. It's supposed to be Christmas. Okay, right now, just the term Christmas, we can go 70 collection hits, and those are all the collections with the reference to Christmas. Now, that's not Christmas just in the title. That's Christmas anywhere. Okay, folder title, item level. Okay, and actually highlight those. Okay, notice the advantage here. Unlike some of the EAD questions I raise, I search across collections, across repositories. Okay, something a lot of EAD systems don't allow. Okay, so we can actually narrow right down, literally going down to a series level, in some instances right to the box. I'm sure everybody's had a researcher come up here, usually a faculty member, who wants something in 5 minutes because they're going to class in 10 minutes. Okay, I don't want to have to go through the finding. Just show me where it's at, pull the box, I'll open up the folder, make a photocopy, run off to class. Not the ideal researcher, but if they're the ones paying the bill, that's what you do. Okay. Here we got Claude Gordon, Christmas. We have under the bottom here, Series 1 Music, Box 4, Folder 17, the title Christmas Medley, and that'll take you right to a specific arrangement by Claude Gordon. Let's go back up to the top, Chris, for a moment and do a subject search. We've done that creator search. Let's Pick a topic, you know, a creator that would be interesting. Suggestion?
Brundage.
Mind you, how many records do we have in this system?
There are 5,700 and some collection records in the system.
That's over 5,000 finding aids, everything. We're running this laptop as the server right now.
Okay. Well, it has two servers at
yes.
the database. It would run about 3 or 4 times faster on an actual web application.
Okay. All right. And then we've got hits on Brundage, including the creator record, so that literally the system allows you not only to create finding aids and so forth, but literally authorities, subject authorities, creator authorities. They can be local headings. They can be LC headings. I mean, it's entirely up to you. In this instance, once again, multiple hits referencing to Brundage. Can we go to the creator record specifically? That's good. Yeah, it doesn't compensate for, you know, human error. And quite frankly, if you look at most computer problems, it's usually the person running the keyboard.
And it doesn't compensate for problems in your data, which is another
issue. Oh, yeah?
So, like two creator records for Brundage.
Based interface problems.
Yes, exactly. Yes, mm-hmm. As a computer technician, yes, sometimes I would rather just replace the carbon-based form. You know, the computer works a lot better. Here we have collection level. Can we go right to the authority record?
Sure. I don't know if there is one for Brundage. I don't think we ever created one.
Yes, we haven't gotten ourselves up to date yet. But here you go. Here's a finding aid referencing, control card. Thank you. Okay, it'll take us to the finding aid. Very straightforward. Looks very similar to a MARC record. Actually, we do generate MARC records. And zip down. Yeah, let's go down to the MARC record. Yeah, your cursor's working fine. It's the carbon-based form problem.
It just keeps jittering on.
Okay. Right now, I mean, as you type the information in this database structure, it actually is then putting information and outputting a MARC record, which we dump right into the library system. You can do it manually. You can do it in batch loads. Right now, we've done it manually. We're setting up the precedent so that once a day, the system comes in, sees what's new in the FTP server directory, and then loads it right directly to the library system. One advantage is if I do work on a finding aid one day, and then I go home, spend the weekend with the kids, I don't have to worry about remembering, geez, did I change the bibliographic record in the library system? Oh, God, now we have two files. You know, the library record says I have 20 cubic feet. My finding aid says I have 200. What is it? And you have a researcher come 2 months later and complain about this. The system will do it both. Again, input once, output many different ways. And we were just at the raw record.
Right.
Got it. So literally, when you export as a raw MARC record right directly into your system. Okay, so we've done creator files, we've done a quick crude subject search, I mean, we've seen the hits, and I'm trying to keep this brief because we could spend 2 hours and still have time. Let's go and log in. Here's another feature that's really neat. Okay, you're working the reference desk. Someone says there's a collection. All right, fine. I want to know where that collection's located. Well, you can log in as an administrator and open up the same file and have two functions going on. See all the data that the public sees, plus everything else that you can only see. Case in point, you need to find out which shelf has that box that you need. I don't want to have to go to a paper file and look it up. I want to be able to look right there and say, oh, okay, this particular box is on this shelf, and oh, yeah, it's remote storage. Okay. Are we there yet?
Sure.
Good.
Mm-hmm.
These are all the collections referencing SUSE. Let's go ahead, and let's not do SUSE because it's huge. Can we do the Cipollone? Of course, now it's basically showing you all of the references. You'll notice suddenly with this record output that you got little pencils. We weren't too creative. We figured, you know, for the administrative part, you want to get to that from the public access, so we just made the icon pencils. So let's click on, and let's go down to the, pick on any pencil, I don't care. We are now directly into the administrative interface. Okay. And you have all the information there, the name of the collection, its extent, address of the repository, literally all the essence of this. Think of it from the other point of view. I got a collection that just walked in the door. I got 8 boxes. I want to be able to at least tag that we've got it, where the extent is, and where it's located. But I don't have to type it 3 times over the space of a month. Here's the start of your record. Okay. We go in, you add your subjects. Where are we at now?
Various details of the collection.
Okay. You're going faster than I am. Again, we have no information restrictions, physical access, but again, these are all components you can plug information for. Some of this information is seen to the public interface, some is only seen through the administrative interface. Let's go to the biographical section so we can look at the actual historical note. Yeah, let's do Cipollone. I hope there's one there. Yep, you did. World's Worst Quiz. There it is, C-I-P-O-L. There it is.
Nope.
Okay, there you go. I've got some homework to do when I get back. We have one for Sousa. Should be able to open that up. All right. Come on. Down, boy. All right, the bottom line is that your authority level at the creator is right here. So literally, you've got the creator. You can determine whether is that creator authority LC compliant or not. So it allows us to use a local term if we wish, or we can clearly establish it as an LC term. If you're using a different authority, what are you doing? You were playing. All right. We were demoing this Tuesday, so, okay. The public interface has the information. But the gist of it is, literally, if your ARC record would output that, and I'm glad we're running standalone, and you have the LC compliant checked as yes, literally that heading would then be displayed with the appropriate association. Okay. Of course, your biographical note, if you want the defining aid, in this instance, the Sousa biography would be 3 lines. Sousa having the ego that he did, he would probably have about 100 lines, but we've truncated that. So here we've got the authority record. You would do the same thing for the scope note. Let's go to the... God, there's so much to cover in so little time. Bingo. Yes. Mm-hmm. You can import EAD files into the system, and the data will then fall into the appropriate places. You can then immediately output it, so it'll look exactly the same as you input it. You can take a MARC record, input the MARC record. It goes in the data set, so you, in essence, have an initial bibliographic record in the system, and then you can kick it back out. One of the things we wanted to do was to enable people to go in and out. So if you have 60 EAD finding aids already in place, there's no one in this room who would want to rekey those, right? Okay, good. Well, we would just import all those.
Yeah, it actually, if you have the control access in your EAD file, it'll automatically check the subject authority file to see if it's there. If it is, it will not add it, but it will associate it. If it isn't there, it will add it and then associate it with the collection.
Yes.
Well, actually, the data that we have in the system and the data that we're...
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. She asked the question, if you have data in another database system, proprietary, Excel, okay, can access, could that be imported into the system? And your answer?
Yes, it can. But that's one of those things where you sort of have to customize your own import script. All of the data that we have in the system here was grandfathered in from previous database structures. Chris was running all of the University Archives data out of a SQL Access database, a SQL database that used Access as an interface. And then Scott was using a totally different structured SQL database. And I just wrote, a one-file script, maybe 50 lines that would import all that. So that would require a little bit more technical knowledge, but it's definitely doable.
So again, a way to get your stuff in, and if you don't like the system 2 years down the road or 6 months, any work you put into it, you can pump it right back out. So you haven't lost anything, and I hope you've added something as a way of playing with it. Yes?
Well, wait a second here. No, that's bad.
Don't write Chris.
No, actually, you. One of the things we have to think about with this piece of software is we need to support it, and we need to find a sustainability model for it. So, you know, we want to engage the community in a conversation about how that can happen. But one of the ways it can happen is by, you know, people paying us to import their data into it, actually. So. Yeah, that's right. We can easily, I mean, it's not easy, but that's one of the things I'm planning on working into it eventually.
You have to realize this is version one. We started running an alpha version in 2004. We went beta about a year ago, and so you're looking at the first public version, and there'll be additional iterations if there's a community need for this kind of stuff. If not, we're going to keep developing it because we bought into it.
Yeah, it's actually running as our production system right now.
Yes, so for all of those people who went to other sessions who basically were told it'll be ready next week or in 6 months, well, here, this is it, okay? It's ready now, okay? You don't have to wait, okay? And it's already, it actually works, okay? In the interest of time, can we go to a couple digital objects just to show, because quite frankly, everybody's into digital stuff, digital libraries. The system will enable you to not only put your still images in, it'll allow you also to put moving images with sound, and sound files. And the real kicker here is you put all of that in the database. You don't put it in separate directories. You can, if you have huge libraries already in place, you can establish links between the information contained within this data to somewhere else. But literally, you can put it all in one place. For anybody who's had to buy servers and autoloaders just to keep stuff running on a day-to-day basis, and if you have to buy three autoloaders because you have three major servers running, you're talking $100,000 and more. Okay, and they have a life cycle of every 3 years, 5 years max. You do the math. Okay, if you're only dealing with one server and one autoloader, it doesn't take but a simple math to figure out what might be a little cheaper to run. The compression algorithms are such that it actually delivers the stuff faster than most of the proprietary stuff that's out there right now. So we get a faster return on data.
Keep it moving along.
Yeah. Okay, fine. What do we got here to show? Got it. All right. Here we got rivals here. We got friendly rivals. It's basically a piece between Herman Belstead and Herbert L. Clark, two major cornet players, and we have a recording of them actually playing together. It's the only surviving recording of these two, super daddies of the cornet. Let's go ahead and play it. We have the published version. Sample. If you want to hear the whole lick, which is pretty impressive, I will play for you later. And we also have moving imageries, and this is actually, we just threw this moving imagery because I don't have any moving imagery from these two guys. So we picked something and stuck it here just to demonstrate this functionality. Chris is going to surprise me. Curiosity killed the cat. What have you provided for us? And please, not the cat one, I hope.
Oh, it is a cat one.
Oh, ouch. Oh. Good. That's okay. Let's stop it.
I don't know if I control.
Well, yeah, curiosity killed the program. I told you, you shouldn't have used that image. Yes, I knew something would get you. No. It was a free thing. It was just, if you were a cat lover, you probably wouldn't have wanted to see this image. But it was a fun piece of humor. All right. Can we stop what it's
anyway,
doing?
Anyway, we're at the point where Deborah.
Yes, let's go ahead and get Deborah to come on up here.
Okay, Deborah. Let me introduce Deborah.
Yes.
The projector just totally crashed.
Did you ever test it on this computer?
Oh, yeah. No, it works fine. Okay. It's a projector.
Okay. Okay.
In any case, as we were developing the software, we worked with
two individuals to do so. One of them could not be here today, and Scott will be giving her presentation in a moment. But we do have with us Deborah Richardson. Deborah is currently the head of the American History Museum, Archive Center, actually, the American History Museum at the Smithsonian Institution. She has a Bachelor of Music degree from Howard University and MLS degree from the University of Maryland, College Park. She's been heavily involved in arts program planning and has performed leadership roles in SAA and in the African American community. Has published articles concerning African American music and collections, including Ulysses K, a biobibliography. And Deborah is active in community organizations involved in numerous in different types of cultural projects. She's been on the staff of the Smithsonian since 1990, and she's going to be talking to us today about her attempts to use this system in its very, very early iterations. So all the advice that Deborah gave us has been integrated into what you just saw. Deborah.
Thank you. And yes, it is very early in the process, and you'll find that it was very early in the process for us. I was introduced to the Archon concept in November of 2005, and I was intrigued by it because I had been exploring off-the-shelf systems and found them to be more expensive than our budget could afford at the moment. I had also recently learned about the Archivist Toolkit, oh, I can see, and had been anxiously awaiting for the development surrounding that project. But this one was coming, and it was coming early. And I heard about it from Scott. Now, Scott, as you had heard, had worked with us at the Archive Center for several years, and I had known him to be a can-do person, somebody who was willing to take risks to find a solution to a problem. As a result, I was interested in discovering more about this management system, and, you know, Scott had left, and he had taken the entire IT support team with him. You know, they just all petered out. Scott left, and they just all left. And the folks who were left were like what Scott was describing earlier. We have a couple of new folks on who are dedicated, who are interested in the technology aspect of what's going on in archives. And they are each dedicated to other things because of the way we're set up. Our budgets are set up so that folks have, you know, they're dedicated, their line is for whatever. So the folks who were left on staff are folks that, like Scott was saying, are really busy, really focused on what they're doing, and so are not really working with this new technology stuff. And we're trying to figure out how to deal with it. So I asked myself, why not try something that would be free? So like many of you, I was interested in finding an archival management system, and the ideal system would follow collections from lead files through acquisitions, through processing, conservation and preservation, and finally through to research use. I was looking for a system with an acquisition module that included not only the basics of prospective donor information, but also the ticklers to remind you to regularly contact them, a system with a processing module that would not only track conservation processes performed upon materials, but also include reminders to help carry out those preservation processes, such as folder replacement and film or tape rewinding, and a system with an inventory module to track locations both permanent and temporary, a system that would track the details and keep the records of collections and collections use and collections users. And we wanted all of this to work together and be thoroughly integrated in a simple turnkey system. Now, I understand that's a tall order. But if you reach for the moon, at least you could land among the stars. So, you know, that's what I was taught. So, anyway, so I thought I'd ask. So when Scott asked if we were interested in trying this system, I felt it was a good fit. At least it was a place to start, and it seemed like it was simple enough to use. So we got the disk, the original prototype, in, I guess, the first one, yeah, that was coming out for folks. We got that in January. And I thought we were just going to load it. Well, I went to our IT services without Scott's help. And, you know, Scott was always the interface for us. So I went there and just said, well, can we put this on? And what I heard was, sure, but it's going to go on a new server. Okay, new server will be up in 2 weeks. Okay. So, well, a couple weeks turned into a couple of months, and a couple of months turned into more, and, well, you know the drill. Our trial run ended up being reduced to putting sample records into the UIUC system via remote access. So I'll tell you a little bit about the Archives Center. Folks, someone asked, why were we doing this if we were not Lone Rangers? And I basically talked to you all about what is going on with our staff. We have a staff of about 12 members who we have a couple who work with primarily with acquisitions, a couple who work with administration, four staff members working with reference and access services, and three who work with processing. So one access staff member, one processing staff member, and one acquisition staff member were selected to work with the system. But as a result of the complications that you heard above, we had the processing staff member and I believe only the access and the processing staff members, right, actually entered any sample records. And following is a summary of the observations made by our staff. In general, staff members found that the system was relatively easy to use, not too techy. The user documentation explanation explained the system fairly well, and the developers of the system were helpful and accessible when information appeared to be unclear. The basic features that we wanted that were not missing, and everybody's was very adamant about this one, we record, as many of you do, we record user use statistics, i.e. the collections used, the boxes pulled, the subject area studied, the number of on-site researchers, remote stats, that kind of stuff. This system does not currently do that, and we would need to work with the developers to see if Archon could support such statistic collection. Also, there was no visible support for following conservation preservation actions, although the locator would indicate that the materials had been moved to treatment labs. Global changes were relatively easy to make. If the name is updated on a collection, the location component, the mark entry, and if set up, the website are all updated at the same time. Authority records were easily created and included source information as well, which Scott pointed out earlier. However, navigating between the collections manager and the creator manager or the subject manager was a bit clunky when creating local authority. That may have been a result of the web interface, I'm not sure, but I know that I was, you know, I'm looking at the collections record, the component, and I'm going to the subject, the creator, the authority record, and then I'm trying to get back, and I'm like, well, how do you get back? Where is it? So anyway, so that was what I called, that was my experience with it being clunky. The location component facilitates real-time location updates, eliminating additional paper searches for collection locations, which you heard earlier. And the content manager allows for entry at any hierarchical level you choose, from item to folder to box to series to collection level, or beyond that. They even have a virtual category if necessary. Because we had a very limited encounter with this system, some questions were left unanswered by our trial. The most important thing I learned, and I think many folks on our staff learned, was that an open source system requires a significant investment of resources, perhaps as much as any of the off-the-shelf product to bring online. And although this system is relatively simple, and I'm sure there are a lot of what did you call them? Code geeks out there. Even though that they're available, it would take cooperation from our web office, our IT department, and also for us, our online cataloging system, in order to make this kind of a system work. Everybody has to be on board and willing to do the support and willing to do the programming and all of that. And for a department like ours, even having the code geeks is not enough for them. They want to be able to do it themselves. So I think it's a great system. It has great potential. And there are other things that we have to work on to make that kind of a transition from an institution such as ours. Thank you very much.
Okay.
The third speaker we had lined up for today was Pamela Coleman Nye. At the time, unfortunately for us, but fortunately, I guess, for Pam, she became pregnant between the time we proposed the session, and she's in the late stages of her pregnancy, was unable to be with us here today. But Pam is an independent consultant, owner of Phoenix Research and Designs. She's currently assisting two smaller archives in organizing their collections. She began her career at the Georgia Archives in 1991 as a volunteer, and eventually became both a senior archivist and then eventually public programs coordinator at the Georgia Archives. Among her duties there were reference, processing collections, and a lot of public relations activities, as you can imagine. She resigned from her position at the Georgia Archives in December 2003 and created her own consulting company, Phoenix Research and Designs. She's an active member of SAA, the Society of Georgia Archivists, and is a certified archivist. And Scott will be presenting her paper on her behalf for us.
For those who knew Pam, just close your eyes and pretend, okay? We're looking at basically, as an overview of her presentation, was, you know, the types of archives she's working on, two different types of repositories, and some, she'll provide some basic background about who they are and what they are. And most importantly, Pam was the individual who could look at the technical requirements, while Deborah is tech-phobic. Pam is more of a risk taker and has a reasonable handle on some of the more basic types of technical requirements. So we were kind of testing both sides of the tracks. Okay. Small church archive. The bottom line, there was no collections management system in place. There's no structure in terms of the governing body for this particular Lutheran church requiring, you know, how records should be preserved or cared for, or more importantly, disposed of. No archivist in place. Never will be an archivist in place. Okay, and like most small church organizations, the papers are down in the basement. Okay, not a great place. So there's your model of her church archives, and quite frankly, I suspect probably about 75% of church archives kinds of repositories. Then we have a special collections. Here we have Marlborough College, and I believe it's Vermont. Again, no dedicated archivist, no college or university archives, and she has yet, and I hope that it'll be sooner than later, but right now there is nobody taking care of their stuff, no policies in place. They do have three special collections that kind of just fell in their lap over time. It's usually how a lot of these small archives kind of evolve. Somebody sort of recognizing, you know, we need to care for the stuff. For the moment, they haven't crossed that border. And most of the other stuff is at the Rice Library, so it's not even in their own repository at this point. So again, a small college archives potential, but not an archives. Oops, there we go. I skipped that, did I? There we go. St. Paul's, established 1969, first Lutheran church in Georgia. Bottom line, if you've been in Georgia, Lutheranism is not a big thing. It's again very small, with approximately 100 members. I do a lot of research in Kentucky. My church is average 25 to 30, so I'm a little smaller than her. But yeah, very small church. Again, Marlborough, established in 1946 by returning GIs. Okay. 336 students. So again, it starts out fairly small. It's a little bit bigger than that now, and largely student-oriented. Now, this is really what the expectations were for these two repositories. I mean, one, for the church, I want to be able to put stuff into the system, have it then be able to organize it in some fashion, and be able to spit it out, basically create finding aids. In some respects, it beats a tenet of good archival practice. You got to have at least some intellectual.
I'm
The mouse and the cat. Okay, here we go. All right, yes, I know. I speak the truth, yes. We should have intellectual order before physical order. But but they're just here, a small church, you know, and they just want to just say what stuff they've got, and eventually some come in and be able to create some intellectual order from all of the lists. Doesn't fit well within the traditional archives mindset, but that's a small repository. All right, I'm done, okay. The other, you know, free and inexpensive, okay, which is a nice way of saying cheap, okay, and easy to use for non-archivists, and that's it. You know, somebody, literally, for some lone archivist who were yesterday, am I an archivist? I'm not sure yet, tell me, okay. Marlborough College, make finding aids easily over the web. So they're already, you know, one step ahead, okay? I know what a finding aid is. I just want to make it available to the public, okay? Yeah, I want to be able to take the program and grow it, and I want it to move across different types of records. And you'll notice the same two themes at the bottom, free and inexpensive and easy to use, okay? Now, Pam started out as a PC person. That was cool. We were trying to make this work in both platforms. We're not Mac at the University of Illinois, so you know, I figured, yeah, we'll set that aside. Then her computer died, and she decided to take a risk, and she went all Mac. She'd never touched a Mac before. Okay, so some of the problems we have here are largely due to that carbon base issue as opposed to the technology. The system works on both platforms, but we haven't worked out the kinks on the Mac. Okay, the gist of it is for Mac, you know, it required a kind of a manual load. This is, I mean, you had to put stuff in. It wasn't as easy plug and play as the PC version. You had to have some knowledge of loading stuff actually creating a server, and then basically being able to do this all in standalone, pretty much what we did here on this laptop. These are extra skills that you would hire a technologist to do, so the lone archivist is leaping maybe out into the technology field. Okay, Windows is autoload, still is autoload. Okay, and this is just an outlining of in her first attempt at load. And yeah, this is kind of scary. She's actually loading the system up, creating the servers and all the requirements before she even goes. This is not something I would expect anyone here to do, unless you're really into technology. The gist of it was, after we got all done, she opened things up and she had a blank page. She says, oh God, we're dead in the water. And then it was trying to figure out what was wrong. She says, okay, let's try another strategy. This is slow. There we go. We then went with a second attempt, going with basically a network server, going in a more PC environment, using Linux and Apache. And the gist of it was we were using PHP 4.42. Problem there is that's an old version of PHP. We need PHP 5 for the system, which is the current version that most people have today. So she was loading something. We developed that for 5 on something it had 4. And the gist of it wasn't backward compatible, and we had a crash and burn. Yes, this is where technology bites you. And when we go to attempt 3, we get yet a new version of it, and we're feeling, you know, again, moving it to the same live server. That presented some problems there. I think what we encountered here is that, Chris is reminding you, it's still PHP 4, so again, maybe it's more a carbon-based issue than it is technical, but the gist of it was, you know, she wasn't making a connection between PHP 5 and 4. We noticed that, okay, we still got the same error messages. You know, I figured, you know, 3 times is the charm, not in this model. And we also did find out in one of the earlier versions that we did screw up, so we have to take some of the credit. We made some of the coding case sensitive, and, you know, we screwed up. We fixed that one real quick. Okay. The gist of it is, was she successful at loading the stuff in a Mac platform? No.
Well, that's actually not. Correct you. That's another carbon-based error, Scott. That's
Thank you.
On your behalf.
Thank you. Fair enough. Ooh. Psst. We're very good friends.
Yeah, no, I know.
The gist of it was she was unsuccessful at getting it to load, even though we were able to load it several times, including at the Smithsonian Tuesday, where we were actually able to load the whole thing in front of a bunch of people. So, quite frankly, yeah, and we did it in 2 minutes. Yeah. I mean, no, on a PC.
It doesn't actually run on a Mac. It runs on a database server and a web server. So you can view these pages and do all the administrative issues through a Mac. That's absolutely no problem at all. It's just that you need to have a database server and a web server to run it, which you can get through any web host or you have at your own institution. Pam was trying to install it on a Mac machine, which is what she shouldn't have done, which we hadn't made clear to her at first.
Okay, so our fault again. But yeah, we have a happy ending here. Bottom line is that the latest version is visually appealing. We've gotten rid of that ugly deep sea blue. We still got the purple up here. Yeah, we got a better color now. Most of the module managers are straightforward and easy to use, and we weren't able to demonstrate most of those, but the bottom line is self-explanatory. Some of the jargon was confusing. Of course, jargon is the terminology we use as archivists, and it does present a problem for somebody who has no archival background. What does this mean? For a lone ranger, someone mentioned yesterday, if I type the stuff in, do I need to know much about how to make finding aids? And I think one of the crucial points is you should have at least some good grounding and some basic principles of archiving before you use the system. If you don't have that, I think the system will fail you. But again, it's a carbon-based problem. It's not the program. Okay. Some of the definitions weren't clear in terms of the fields, and again, we've corrected those through updates. What does this mean? This term doesn't exactly say what it should. So again, as this early development was going on, we were really working as a team how best to define things so that at least everyone could come to some agreement that this is what this means. And this is just the user interface, or the administrative. Pros and cons for the user interface. Ability to customize the look and feel to mirror your site. We can't show it here right now, but literally the University Archives and SUSE Archives running off the same data set. You guys go to our pages and you wouldn't know that. They're totally distinct. Okay, and it doesn't take much effort to make those changes.
In fact, the only thing you need to do is modify 3 HTML files in order to customize the look and feel.
And as you point out, one of the things is everything is done in real time. You send an update to the system, and everyone sees that. Okay, there's no delay. Okay, so there's an immediate return. For those of us who, grew up in the 70s and want everything now, the system here can deliver that. And I love this. Cons, well, there were none that she could think of, and she can't even blame me for having her try this out. Final notes, have good documentation as part of the product. We have included that in the free disk. What was it, 30, 35 pages of documentation now and how to use the system, both from the public aspect and from the administrative aspects. And we'll probably be tweaking that some more, but we were able to get that in much better shape. Manual installation of the program is not simple and not intuitive, and bottom line, that's why we made it automatic. And if we really like to kind of keep it that way. Testing of newly developed software sometimes is a challenge. If anybody's done software development, there isn't a programmer on the planet who will admit, at least in public and most likely in private too, that they're going to get it right on the first crack. Okay, we came pretty close, and we kept massaging until we came to what really worked. And that's part of development. That's part of the risk-taking here. The potential for the program, as Deborah pointed out, is exciting. There's lots of applications, and we have only scratched the surface. And for those who are still looking for Pam, she's in the box. Actually, her daughter's the pretty little one in pink, and she's just kind of holding her up. I'm just let you know that she hasn't dropped off the face of the earth. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Scott. We are running a little bit short on time. I've heard we can run over about 5 minutes or so. So I do have a couple of quick things I'd like to show you. We talked a little bit about the installation routine, and we'd just like to show a little bit about how that works. We're not actually going to try to install it right now because that would be fairly time-consuming. It would take about 2 or 3 minutes to run. But basically, we have developed an installation utility for this piece of software. So if you have a database server,
at your institution, or if you have a web host. I have a web host myself. It costs me $7 a month. And every web host out there will have basically what you need to install this. Most institutions should have it, although what Deborah ran into was an administrative roadblock, actually, at the Smithsonian that didn't want to install PHP for her. Basically, all you need to do is give these variables to it. You need, obviously, to name the server type, the address, the login, the password. My system administrator usually gets these to me within 2 to 3 hours of my asking. So if your system administrator isn't giving it to you, there's a problem there, but that's something we can't solve. Okay, so that's the installation routine. One other thing I'd like to just address briefly, and I don't know if, Chris, you can bring my presentation back up, is I did just want to give you some idea in about 2 minutes here about what future directions we kind of are thinking about for this product. And I can't remember what those are right now, so I'll have to look at my... I mean, I have about 70 of them, but there's a couple I really wanted to hit on. So if you go down to slide 4, I believe. Yeah, no, there's the big PR one. Okay, so our immediate goal is really to build a user community of some type. That could just be institutions that are trying it out informally. That could be institutions that would like to implement it more formally. It could be really anything you would want it to be. But we need to develop some kind of a sustainable funding model for it. We do need to maintain it internally, and of course the library will maintain it internally to the extent that it's able. But to the extent that we can develop another model for it, that's really where I'm putting a lot of my attention currently. Second point, we would like to do some enhancements specifically to the digital library component. Build in additional metadata elements. We want to keep it fairly lightweight, but build some additional ones in. We would also like to make it OAI data provider, and that I'm getting way off into technical jargon here that many of you probably don't care two whits about, but we would also like to make it a METS, able to export METS objects. Basically what that means is that it would be able to export the digital object information into other systems so that it would be findable in other place. And one of the really interesting components I personally would like to work on is building a user annotation system into it so that when users come to the website and look at your collection, they can kind of do a little wiki-type operation on it and add some information to the collection. Now, I wouldn't let them modify the descriptive records we create, but providing a user area to add comments in, I think, would be particularly effective. You know, we get requests all the time, say, oh, well, that's a little bit wrong, and then, well, how can I correct it? And, well, send it to me, and I'll add it. And so anyway, we would like to see that built into it. And we're going to be doing some usability testing on it. So there it is, and we'd welcome your questions. Susan? How many megabytes of data is it? Well, I think what we're running on here... Oh, I'm sorry. The question was how scalable is it? I can just... Oh, well, you can hold as much as the SQL Server or the MySQL database can hold, so it's really a hardware issue. The one thing we need to do some testing on is how much can it, how fast are the search algorithms. One of the things Chris here is doing next semester is taking a database class, which goes very deeply into, you know, how you create effective search algorithms. It actually is a very robust system. If we're to... We are running approximately 5,700 collection level records currently, and there's I don't know how many, you know, full finding aids in it.
I mean, so here's just I just pulled up a description of the database manager that describes all the tables of the database and how many rows that represents. So, for example, in the collections table you see here, there are 6,000 collections. Content means content level descriptions, like box folder listings. You have 17,000. In there, 40,000 subject associations, like 5,000 subjects themselves, 2,500 creators. So already this is running off a fairly large data set.
What's
and
the total megabyte that you
about 20 megs usage right now.
Yeah, and of course that's compressed data too because it's in the database. So we think it's fairly scalable. One of the other things that's built into it, since it's all built, and again, I'm getting way off into techno-geek jargon here, it's built on an object-oriented model, and the database itself is an object, so that you can aggregate multiple instances of this together and do cross-repository searching, each which would be run on the old database, but then the search results would be aggregated in the script, the PHP script at the end. So we think it's very scalable. We currently, if you were to run a search on our production system for really a very difficult to run, well, a search where you'd really be pulling a lot of data back would be for SUSE, for instance, because it's in so many collections. That'll run in, what, about 3 seconds or so? And it actually starts loading up immediately, so the user doesn't really see any delay. Here you see some delay because we're asking this laptop to do more than it should ever be asked to do. No, there's a, yeah. Yeah, the question is the question is essentially, do you have to have things online? Yes, in a sense you do, but I can just say if you didn't want to have it online and online accessible, you just don't link to it from, you put it on a web server and then not link to it. So if you had a church archives and didn't have a web host, this really wouldn't be appropriate to them. But from my point of view, the whole purpose of the system was to put information online, so that would be maybe not the right solution in that instance. Now, there are other, tools that are out there. So
I would actually just comment on that and say that if, for example, a church archivist wanted to do something very similar to what we're doing here on this laptop, where they use it just for their internal management, that's certainly possible. So it doesn't have to go online. It's designed for it so that the public has one access point where they can search all the collections and find what they're looking for, and researchers can find what they're looking for. And there's the internal management component. But if an archivist chooses not to use the public interface, that's certainly their choice, and you could just use it on a desktop machine or a laptop or something to that effect.
Another question right back here. Yes, we just uploaded it. Well, we've had it basically in its final form for the past week or so. The question is, has it been released already, and what license are we using? It has been released. Scott actually has discs of it here to distribute. We'll I probably run out, but it's also on our website, which is if you can just bring that up, Scott. Right. Well, it's on my last slide, actually. www.archonproject.org. And it's released under an academic and research use license, which means the source code is open. We're allowing anybody to customize the source code to whatever extent they believe necessary. But it's not like a general public license thing. The issue we were concerned about, and that our licensing people were concerned about, is that if we released it that way, we would lose control of the software, essentially. The other issue is a lot of open source projects, and Brad Westbrook actually hinted at this earlier today too, a lot of them kind of wither on the vine, and unless there's a home institution that takes responsibility for them, it isn't necessarily the right thing to release it as open source. So we welcome additions to the code. We welcome, people using it and modifying it however they want, but we don't want a commercial entity coming along, taking it over, tweaking it a little bit, and then selling it. I mean, that's bad from our point of view. And from the university's point of view, because we sunk a lot of resources into developing it, we want to get some resources back to maintain it.
I think one of the things that we need to emphasize is that you can play with it. If you come up with a module that is very cool and clearly is an addition to what we've got, we're willing to look at it, and if it doesn't break the system, we will put it out. I mean, we become sort of the gatekeepers to ensure that if people are using it, we don't want something going out that then breaks your data.
Right, or if the code is so sloppy that it just doesn't, you just don't want it in there.
The other thing I'll point out, too, when you first log into the system, when you see this message, "Welcome to the Archon Administrative Interface," as new versions are released, a message will appear there to let you know that something new is out and make it very easy for you to download it so you can upgrade your system. So it's... Yes.
Yeah, the way it works is when there's an install, you're given a warning during the installation procedure, but your installation information, including your server addresses, is sent back to us we maintain it in a database. We will not share it with anybody, obviously. We use that only for notification so that you can upgrade the system when you want to. Okay, another question here?
Yes,
it's available on our website. Same thing that's on the disk. Another question? Well, I mean, the question is, what's the funding model that we anticipate for it? We have some internal money that we're funding it on right now, and that's going to keep us going for another year or so at least, I would think. After that point, we're developing grant applications currently, which is one possibility. The other thing is to develop a user community that contributes code to it. I've already mentioned the option of people contracting with us to import data into it. So there's a couple of possibilities out there, but you know, we need to kind of think about those a little bit and work on it. The key thing first is to see whether people are interested in it and whether they're actually going to go beyond just being interested in it and using it. Okay. Yeah, we'll just do two more questions and then we need to get going here. Okay.
I was curious.
Yeah, we had actually thought about that, putting little buttons in there. One of the things that came up, for example, with the church archives was we have the scope content field labeled scope. Well, they didn't know what that was. I mean, basically, it's description. So, you know, we could change it to that. So we're thinking about integrating field helps. If there's any other ideas, we'll look at those too. Okay, we had someone with a red pen right here. Okay, so the question is, how much space does it need on the server? The scripts on the web server basically are about 2 megabytes, and then the database server, that's going to be as much as you dump into the database. So. Okay, thank you all very much. We do have copies of the disks here.
Yes, come up if you want a disk.